Good evening. California makes it official. Biden and Harris are certified. Stephen Miller says fight on, and the Proud Boys fight for Trump in D.C. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI News for Monday, December 14th, 2020. As the pandemic that's claimed 300,000 lives in the United States alone rages on, the much-heralded and feared vaccine that many hope will eradicate COVID-19 has arrived. Sandra Lindsay, a critical care nurse at Long Island Jewish Center, rolled up her sleeve and received the shot on live television. It was narrated by Governor Andrew Cuomo.
So New York State has been working very hard to deploy it, get it out. We have trains, planes, and automobiles moving this all over the state right now. We want to get it deployed, and we want to get it deployed quickly. And we're here to watch you take the first shot. So, Michael Dowling, Dr. Chester, Sandra Lindsay, we're all with you.
Governor, thank you so much. And as you said, we're in eastern Queens. And as you know, Queens was the epicenter of the COVID issue back a number of months ago. This is where it hit the hardest. And this facility, Long Island Jewish, was right at the center. And here at Northwell, you know, we've seen well over 100,000 COVID patients. And at one point back in April, we had over 3,500 patients in our hospitals. And of course, of the frontline staff of all of the, and all of the hospitals and all of the facilities across the region did spectacular work. And as you said, they are the real heroes. So with that, Dr. Chester, we'll turn it over to you.
Thank you. How are you feeling today?
I'm feeling great.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going into the left deltoid.
Sandra, you didn't flinch. I take it that Dr. Chester has a good touch.
She has a good touch, and it didn't feel any different from taking any other vaccine.
Great.
Governor Cuomo said this is the light at the end of the tunnel, but it's a long tunnel, and we need people to continue to do the right thing and the smart thing all through the holiday season. Mayor Bill de Blasio said this morning the vaccine will arrive at five hospitals in the city today, followed by 37 on Tuesday and two more on Wednesday. Mayor said he was impressed by the courage of the frontline workers.
One of the precautions in the state of New York made a decision, and I agree with that decision, was to tighten up some of our restrictions. And as of this morning, indoor dining is no longer in effect in New York City for the foreseeable future. Again, the more we fight back against the disease, the more the vaccine is distributed, that situation will change. And sooner rather than later, I believe. But those restrictions are in effect now. Indoor dining is not happening, but outdoor dining continues. Takeout and delivery continue. The folks who work in our restaurant industry, they've been through hell, let's be clear. We've got to bring this industry back. We've got to bring back the restaurants we love, but it's going to take time. In the meantime, we got to stay safe.
And that was Mayor de Blasio announcing that starting today, there will be no more indoor dining at restaurants in New York City. In addition to healthcare workers, nursing home staff and residents are also at the top of the list to get the vaccine. New York City is currently preparing to receive and administer 465,000 doses over the next 3 weeks. We'll have more on the story later in the newscast. And presidential electors in key battleground states cast the vote Monday, affirming Joe Biden as the nation's next president. The final vote, putting him over 270 electoral votes, came from the state of California just moments ago. It gives him the majority of votes and makes him the president-elect of the United States quite officially and certified as such. California's 55 electoral votes put Biden over the top. Heightened security was in place in some states as electors met on the day that's set by federal law. They cast paper ballots in gatherings that took place in all 50 states and the District of Columbia. Usually a formality, it was important this year because of President Donald Trump's refusal to concede he lost the race for re-election. Earlier today, Michigan counted its 16 votes for Biden. The state has seen armed pro-Trump protests at the state capitol, and its officials have had their lives threatened. Governor Gretchen Whitmer is a Democrat.
Biden has chosen a clear winner for the office of President of the United States and for every elected office up and down that ballot. The people have spoken. It was a safe, fair, and secure election. It was the kind of election our founding fathers envisioned when they created this democracy and built this country. And after today, the results will be final.
Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Pennsylvania saw a concerted effort by Trump and his lawyer Rudy Giuliani to overturn the election, blocked in the courts and in the state legislature. It cast its 20 votes for Biden.
The electors of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania have cast 20 votes for the Honorable Joseph R. Biden for President of the United States and 20 votes for the Honorable Kamala D. Harris for Vice President of the United States.
And in Georgia, Stacey Abrams announced the results to cheers.
The undersigned 2020 Georgia electors cast each of their respective ballots for President of the United States of America as follows. Joseph R. Biden of the state of Delaware, number of votes received, 16. Kamala D. Harris of the state of California, number of votes, 16.
And the scene on the floor of the Georgia State House, that was the scene on the floor of the Georgia State House as the state casts its electoral votes for Joe Biden. Meanwhile, Trump's allies are preparing to send an alternate slate of electors to Congress, according to White House advisor Stephen Miller. It's a sign Trump will drag out his efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 election, even after today's Electoral College vote. Miller spoke on Fox News earlier today.
The only date in the Constitution is January 20th. So we have more than enough time to right the wrong of this fraudulent election result and certify Donald Trump as the winner of the election. As we speak today, an alternate slate of electors in the contested states is going to vote, and we're going to send those results up to Congress. This will ensure that all of our legal remedies remain open. That means that if we win these cases in the courts, that we can direct that the alternate slate of electors be certified. The state legislatures in Georgia, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania can do the same. And likewise, Congress has that opportunity as well to do the right thing. If you just cured three simple constitutional defects, Donald Trump's the winner of this election.
White House advisor Stephen Miller. Fair Vote is a nonpartisan organization advocating electoral reform in the United States. A senior fellow for the group is David Daley.
It's important to remember that when we vote for president, we're not actually voting for the candidate we prefer, but for a slate of electors. And on December 14th, after this process of certification that has been a whole lot more interesting and complicated this year than in the past goes on, the electors meet in state capitals and they officially cast their ballots. The 538 electors in the Electoral College who actually choose the next president will today vote over the course of the day. Trying to convince electors to become faithless electors, trying to convince the 538 members of the Electoral College to vote for him and not for Joe Biden. Now, that is not going to happen. There has only been one elector in the history of the Electoral College, and you have to go back to 1796 for this, who has voted for the opposite candidate when it comes time for electors to cast their ballot. Trump would need something like 37 or 38 of those to switch. It simply does not happen. The other option, we still see Trump and some Republicans attempting today, is that you have in some of these state capitals alternate slates of electors, Republican electors, that are meeting, and they are going to send themselves to the Capitol for the January 6th date when the electoral votes are read and accepted by Congress. Now, those slates will not have been certified. So there is zero chance that this is going to cause an additional problem. But it does mean that the drama is likely to continue all the way through January 6th.
Did the founders of this country expect, or did anybody who voted on all the different amendments and laws in order to determine elections and outcomes in American history ever predict this kind of thing happening?
What we've all learned over the course of this year is just how flimsy some of the guardrails are that protect our democracy. There was a court challenge this week in Wisconsin that would have potentially thrown out 200,000 votes in the state of Wisconsin that were legally and appropriately cast. And it was only a 4-3 decision by the state Supreme Court there. One state Supreme Court justice is the margin that kept democracy on track there. While we tout ourselves as the world's greatest democracy, so much of our institutional processes are based on norms and traditions and recurring practices. And when one side simply decides that they don't want to play by those rules anymore, there is very little holding the system from careening wildly off the road.
What do we have to look for as far as changing the laws, or what can be done to prevent this from happening this way again?
A responsible Republican Party would be a terrific thing. We have to look really, really seriously at a national popular vote or the National Popular Vote Compact. Joe Biden won the Electoral College rather narrowly. We're only talking about 10,000 votes in Arizona, about 11,000 votes in Georgia, the margin in Wisconsin, a little larger, but still fairly close. And if about 70, 80,000 votes had gone the other way in a handful of states, you're looking at what was a 7 million vote margin for Joe Biden being erased by the Electoral College.
David Daley is senior fellow for the group Fair Vote, and President-elect Joe Biden will address the nation tonight at 7 p.m. And in news that's just coming over the wire, Attorney General William Barr, an outspoken proponent of conservative values and an expansive view of presidential power, will leave office before Christmas. President Trump announced that in a tweet just moments ago. Trump said that he and Barr had a very nice meeting at the White House and that their relationship has been a very good one. Deputy Attorney General Jeff Rosen will become acting Attorney General, according to Trump. In a letter to the president, Barr said he's proud to have played a role in the Trump administration and said he would depart December 23rd. Earlier this month, Barr said the Department of Justice found no evidence of widespread election fraud, directly contradicting President Trump's baseless claims that the election was stolen by Democrats. Ahead of the election, Barr had stood by the president, repeating his substantiated claims that mail-in voting was ripe for fraud. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Over the weekend, thousands of pro-Trump protesters descended on Washington, D.C. as part of a Stop the Steal rally coming on the heels of a pro-Trump bus tour. It was smaller than an earlier rally, but angry. Loyalty to Trump was manifest by participants who came from all parts of the country. They gave a rousing reception to former General Michael Flynn, pardoned by Trump after he pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI and other offenses. But the real love occurred as Trump's helicopter overthrew the protest on his way to the Army-Navy game.
There you go. There he is. See, he heard me call his name. He's a sneaky guy, but he's a fighter. He's a fighter.
And that's General Flynn speaking before the crowd. By the way, Navy lost to Army 15-0. And that night, after the speechifying and all the people were mulling about in the area there in front of the White House, marauding gangs of the Proud Boys, a far-right extremist group, went through the streets looking for fights. Four people were stabbed in downtown D.C. In relation to that, the injuries were not life-threatening. A video of the fight shows a black man surrounded and pummeled by a crowd of Proud Boys. The man, 29-year-old Philip Johnson, was charged with assault, allegedly for stabbing the four Proud Boys. More than 30 others were arrested. At one point, the Proud Boys ripped down Black Lives Matter banners from two historic black churches near the White House and then burned them. Refuse and resist activist Carl Dix was in touch with counter-protesters in Washington. He says the Proud Boys' target speaks for itself.
Something that actually Bob Avakian said this. There's a direct line from the Confederacy to today's fascists, and you see it with these MAGA mobs, and especially concentrated with the Proud Boys, because they come into D.C. and from one end, they're trying to steal an election, one that they lost, and raising that maybe we shouldn't be in this union. I mean, Alan West actually is the one that raised the question of secession. But then what do they target? They go after Black Lives Matter signs, tearing them down and burning them. They went onto some private property, tore down the signs belonging to these historic black churches, burned one of them, and did not skulk around and sneak around doing it. They marched in good-sized numbers. They took videos of themselves doing it and posted it online. You could identify them as having done it. None of them get harassed by the police. No arrests have yet been made. And in fact, one of the Proud Boys supposedly got an invite to the White House on Saturday. So that's the stance that the main authority, the federal authorities, are taking to this. These are their people. And we should remember that Trump said to them in his first debate with Biden, stand by. Well, this is what they were standing by to get active doing, to spread a message of Trump uber alles and to go physically attack people, to damage people's property, and to target especially the stirrings among black people saying, stop having your police kill us. Well, these people want to take that message down and destroy it. People need to look at it.
Well, what should be the response to something like this?
The response to this should be, you people don't get to have the monopoly on the streets. People who don't want to see this happen need to go into the streets themselves with the message, Trump, you lost, pack your stuff and get out of here, and take your Proud Boys and your MAGA idiots with you. Because these people are announcing their intention to be around and to be in the field, even if Trump does end up having to leave the White House on January 20th, which is what it's looking like it's likely to be. But these guys aren't going to go away, and we cannot allow them to be dominating the streets and pushing into the public square and the public debate their racist, fascist, white supremacist thug mentality and message. I mean, Joe Biden's going to reach across the aisle to work with people, 126 of whom in the House of Representatives signed on to Trump's ridiculous overturn this election with a specific thrust of don't count these black votes in Milwaukee, in Detroit, in Atlanta, and in Philadelphia. We're going to stand up and oppose it because we refuse to accept a fascist America.
And that's Refuse and Resist activist Carl Dix. Meanwhile, back in New York, the New York Times reports last week at least 55 inmates at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn, a federal jail, tested positive for the coronavirus. The attorney in charge for Federal Defenders of New York, a legal advocacy group, is Deirdre Von Dornum. She says officials at the jail aren't following basic public health guidelines to prevent the spread of the virus or treat the sick.
There are over 80, perhaps as many as 90 new cases of COVID in the last week, and that's according to what the facility is reporting out. We've talked, the federal defenders have spoken to at least 25 of the people who are on the affected units, and they've said that contrary to what the jail is claiming to the courts and to, you know, the Congress people, that there is not medical care being provided. Someone comes around every two or three days and checks their temperatures, but they're not being asked about any symptoms. Their oxygen levels are not being monitored. They're not being given Tylenol. In several of the units, the water in the sinks is running brown, and they're all locked in currently because of the outbreak, so they have no fresh drinking water. And the jail is saying that everything's under control, that, you know, every person who comes in is tested and quarantined, but they have no explanation for why, were that the case, there would be this large an outbreak on the general housing units if everyone had been tested and quarantined appropriately.
What are you asking for? What should they do?
We are asking, first of all, for officers to be tested. When we visit, we very frequently see staff members with no masks at all walking around in the housing units, being close to us, being close to people in custody. And obviously the officers come in and out from the community daily. And there's no current testing of officers or requirement that officers be tested. So we would ask that officers be required to wear their masks. The jail will say that's their policy, but they don't enforce it. And then we would ask for officers to be tested so that they don't return to the facility unless they've tested negative. There are at least 20 officers who've been working on these units with a big outbreak, and they just continue to go back and forth from the community each day. Secondly, we'd ask for actual medical care. Obviously, many people suffer very severely from COVID and never have a high temperature. So it doesn't help the people who are having trouble breathing and having bad gastrointestinal problems if they don't have a fever. And even for those people who are feverish, they're just being left in their cells and their temperature is being written down. So we would ask for actual medical care for people who are suffering. And third, there are a number of high risk people held there according to the CDC definitions. They should be held separately and monitored even more closely than everyone else since they're most at risk and the facility knows exactly who those people are.
The idea you get is that a federal lockup is full of bad hombres, as the president likes to say, but in fact, aren't there people who might be eligible for a non-violent offense release?
And I would, of course, resist the idea that depending on what you did, you should get different treatment. I think everyone in the custody of the federal government should get medical care and clean drinking water. But it's certainly the case that there are a number of people, first of all, who are pretrial and so have not been convicted of anything and should be released on bail during this pandemic. But secondly, people who are either charged with or have been recently convicted of fraud offenses, nonviolent narcotics offenses, or other offenses where they certainly could be released temporarily and then returned to serve their sentences if necessary after the pandemic, but they should not have a death sentence.
Deirdre Von Dornum is the attorney in charge for Federal Defenders of New York, a legal advocacy group. And that's some of the news for Monday, December 14, 2020. The news is producer Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From New York City, for the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening.